Good morning. May it please the Court.
Good morning.
To answer a question that was asked...
Can you tell us who you are first?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm Jerry Falk on behalf of the appellant.
Thank you.
Auditors. To answer a question that was posed in the previous case, although I don't think it matters to the outcome of mine, Verner, the proponent of the defense, has the burden of proof, and we've cited some cases that say that on pages 22 to 23 of our opening brief in this case. Of the three cases that you are hearing this morning, this one has the greatest potential economic impact. Mr. Verner's theory attacks the business model used in the software industry and that has been used for upwards of 30 years. Software companies regularly grant licenses to the software copies they distribute rather than transfer them outright, sell them outright. And the license rights are typically subject to material restrictions both on transfer and on use. Verner seeks a ruling today that would convert these standard software arrangements into outright sales for purposes of copyright law. That would destroy the business model used in the industry and make software routinely subject to resale.
Well, if we ruled in favor of Verner, if we ruled in your favor that Verner is not entitled to claim the benefit of the first sale doctrine, is there a way for us to restrict our holding to the software context?
Well, I don't think so, I'd be candid. I think that in theory, the same rule could apply to books, CDs, and DVDs. But that has always been true. After all, the law on this, I hope to persuade you, has been settled in this circuit for quite some time. But book publishers and CD manufacturers don't distribute to consumers in a shrink-wrapped way with a license. They may be shrink-wrapped for other reasons, but they don't purport to be licensed. Books have always been sold at the bookstore and in the CDs at the record store.
But nothing would stop them from changing that model, right? So the book could go out with a shrink wrap license and then put the libraries out of business. Is that?
I think in theory, they could be shrink wrapped and sold on a licensed model, and that has always been so. There are commercial reasons why they don't do that, and there are no particularly good commercial reasons for their doing it. All of the reasons explained in the briefs, and we'll touch on today, time permitting, that have always impelled the software industry to use a licensing model have no corresponding benefits to book publishers or CD issuers. And so there's no particular business reason to do that. They would enormously alienate their customers if they were to do it.
Is it just the use of copying that distinguishes your product?
No, it's certainly one of them. But it's more than that. It has to do with the way software is marketed in part, with differential pricing. You'll recall from the briefs a discussion of educational licenses, which are sometimes free and in any event discounted. They couldn't do that if that software disk could be sold to anybody. And, of course, the new buyer is not in privity with the software company, so the contract terms wouldn't bind the new buyer. So software licenses for educational purposes, if they were converted into software sales, those disks could be readily resold to commercial users. And that would preclude, as a practical matter, educational licenses. The whole differential pricing model that is so important in the software industry, because they can tailor the price to the use or uses that the buyer will put it to.
Well, let me ask you this. We have a number of cases looking at what makes a license in this context. But it doesn't seem like we could just say anyone who puts the word license on a piece of paper has created a license. Where should we draw the line, or do we not have to reach that in this case?
Well, I'm sure you would want to make your ruling as clear as possible. I think you have done it already.
Judges like bright lines.
And so that
we can say, okay, this makes sense.
And so do litigants. And so do private citizens. But I think you have a bright line, at least a very good guidance in the more recent cases in the circuit, which have said where you have a license and substantial or material restrictions on transfer, and to that I would add and use. I don't know that it's necessary, but it's an additional point. Where you have a license and material restrictions on transfer and material restrictions on use, which you typically have in a software context, then you have so many sticks from the original bundle withheld from the licensee that you can confidently say this is not a sale. I think it's important when you think about these kinds of transactions to recall that the disk starts with the software company. The software company creates the software, they manufacture the disk, they put it in a box and package it, documentation and so forth, and they own it. At that point, they are clearly the owner. Now they transfer it to a customer. They don't have to, they define the terms on which they are willing to part with it and which sticks in the bundle they are conveying and which sticks they are.
When I look at significant restrictions, I take it that you're arguing against a requirement that one of those significant restrictions would have to be you have to send it back when you're done with it, because Autodesk doesn't require that.
And I don't.
So how do I tell the difference between a significant restriction and a restriction that doesn't rise to that level?
Well, it would be a restriction that has some material consequence. There is no reason to require return of the software copy. When it is used and the customer doesn't want it anymore.
But if you had required that, that would be something that would be better for you under the current case law.
No, it wouldn't make any difference under the current case law, Judge Callahan.
Well, if you had required that, wouldn't you be arguing that that was one of the things that we should consider and why there was a license?
It would just make
sense. I think that would be disingenuous to say you wouldn't argue that.
Would argue whatever is available.
Yeah, it would be to your advantage if that were present,
But it isn't required by any case law. The relevant case law on this, Hampton rejects that requirement as meaningful. DSC from the Second Circuit rejects that requirement as so do several district court cases.
So it's not dispositive. But, let's say it's not dispositive.
Well, I think it's more than not dispositive. It's meaningless. There's no reason to return it. It's a worthless piece of plastic.
You say you own, though, which your client says they own. So if you own something, why aren't you getting it back? I mean, I think that's a reasonable question.
Because we're equally satisfied to have it rest in a drawer or on a shelf or be destroyed. It's the ownership value, the value of ownership in this case, in this kind of situation, is control of use, not return, because it can be made for pennies. It has no reuse value to the software company. It's probably obsolete by the time anyone would send it back. This software is upgraded quite regularly. The software in this case had already been upgraded and replaced by more modern software, and then our customer, CTA, sold the old software. And that's what is the subject of this case. So there's no reason to, all we would be doing by that kind of a requirement, if this court were to say that's what you have to do in order to have a valid software license and avoid the first sale doctrine, and software companies were to do that, it would be very good for business for the post office or the airlines or Federal Express. We have a lot of waste of resources, and it would accomplish absolutely nothing.
Do you make any distinction between ownership of the disk and ownership of the copyright use?
Yes, we own both, and that's what this contract quite clearly spells out. But in law, it is a significant distinction.
Mm-hmm.
It's conceded we own the copyright, and what we're disagreeing about in this case is who owns the copy,
the disk. Yeah.
And the license agreement is very clear on that.
So you're saying that significant restrictions per wall data would be we're limiting how you use it and we're limiting how you're transferring it. And that as long as a license has those two element and calls itself a license, that would meet the wall data criteria. Is that, yes. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. And I believe that that's what this court has said in a consistent line of cases. Judge Canby, you referred to earlier the Hampton case. That's exactly where I would start in the analysis, because it's actually the first of the line of cases. So you start with Hampton, which focused on the very issue of permanent possession versus necessity of return, and also the one-time payment argument, and rejected both of them and found that that transaction involved a sale. Now, that wasn't a first sale case, but the connection to the first sale doctrine was made in the Wise case, which followed it, and cited Hampton with approval, and cited Hampton as dispositive of the first sale case. Something you said in Wise is very important for this case, and I want to just quote it. From page 1190, footnote 17 of Wise, with respect to the meaning of first sale, we adhere to the reasoning of Hampton. And that's in the discussion of the return point and the one-time payment point. So the line between Hampton and its rejection of those factors as not dispositive and the first sale doctrine was drawn in Wise.
Notwithstanding that line of cases, I guess I still have this question. Why isn't this a question of state law? It's a contract agreement, and our cases say we look at state law of contract unless it interferes with federal law or policy. Why wouldn't we look at the relevant state law?
I think it is a somewhat mixed choice of law result. The cases do say that there has to be uniformity of the rule in order to have one national copyright system. But I think that you can extract from the cases that the starting point for analysis is state contract law. I don't think there's really any difference between what might be a federal common law rule and state contract rule in terms of the formation or interpretation of this contract. There's no real contract interpretation dispute here. The contract is clear enough. So then the question is, does federal law somehow trump the party's characterization of the agreement in this case as a license with the reservation of several major sticks, including the right of resale, the right to use it outside the Western Hemisphere is withheld, and there are other details of some import in the license agreement.
Do you want to reserve your remaining 2 minutes
yes,
for rebuttal?
Yes, I meant to do that. And
okay.
I was so excited I forgot.
I know, you forgot to tell us your name and you just jumped right in. I saw you moving your lips out in the audience before you got here.
I better sit down if I answered
okay.
your question.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Greg Beck. I represent the appellee, Timothy Verner. I'd like to start by trying to clear up what I think is a confusion in the word license. And the reason there's confusion as to this word is because Autodesk uses it and the software industry in general uses it in two different and inconsistent senses. First of all, a license, as used in the Copyright Act itself, is a grant of rights, a portion of the copyright owner's rights under the statute. So for example, you could grant someone a license to print copies of a book. And that's what happened in Hampton. Hampton was about assignment of the exclusive right to perform movies in a movie theater. So that's a case about assignment of rights. But the way that Autodesk uses the word license is as a form of property transfer that is really sort of like a lease. If this agreement had been called a lease agreement, and it had said that we are leasing this software to you, and there is no other, everything else was the same, there is no periodic payments, no return date, nobody would believe that it's actually a lease. But the fact that Autodesk uses the word license throws this element of confusion in it by melding the concept of ownership of copyright and the concept of ownership of a copy. And I wanted to address what Judge Canby asked about whether how the disk itself, in the case of music, is different from the music that is stored on the disk.
If you're moving on to that, before you move on to that, just you just said it creates confusion. I don't understand why the use of the word license creates confusion. It's a concept both in federal and state law, and we've upheld license agreements between the manufacturer and the recipient of software. So where's the confusion there?
The term license in this context was developed by the software industry for the purpose of evading the first sale doctrine. That's what the Third Circuit said in the StepSaver versus Weiss case. And the reason it's confusing is because it's used in two senses. In the one sense, it's the license agreement says we are granting or reserving certain rights, and it says that's the license. But on the other hand, it also treats it as if this is a limited form of title transfer, a limited form of property transfer in which no property is actually transferred, but that Autodesk retains ownership of the physical object.
And why is that not okay? We let parties contract fairly flexibly, and this is an established form of contract. Is there something in state contract law or in federal copyright law that doesn't allow that sort of contract?
No, and if there were an actual lease, then Autodesk would be absolutely right. For example, Netflix sends you a movie every month. Everybody understands that they're not actually selling it to you. So if you went out and sold your Netflix movie after receiving it, you'd have a copyright problem.
So are you saying that the person who enters into a license is deceived or confused by the nature of the contract?
No, I'm saying that you have to look at the economic realities of the exchange rather than the label that is put on the transaction to determine what it actually is.
Well, why isn't Wall Data, which says if the copyright owner makes it clear that he or she is granting only a license and impose significant restrictions on the purchaser's ability to redistribute or transfer that copy, why isn't that enough? Well, we said that's a license. You call it a license and you put some significant restrictions.
Well, I have a couple points on that. First of all, immediately after that statement, there's a footnote in which the court backs away from that statement to some degree. And I think that there would be no reason for a panel to express doubt about what it just said and then state that there's a more fundamental ground on which to decide the case if it meant that to be binding on future panels. Because a precedent is something that is considered and intentionally decided by a panel. But
I just have to tell you that in the Ninth Circuit, we say that all dicta is precedent and binding on us.
There's the United...
For our chief judge.
For Berrapin v. Inamoto and many other cases.
there's a recent decision, United States versus Johnson, that discusses in detail the concept of an en banc decision that discusses the concept of what dicta is and what's binding on future panels. And it is true that an alternative holding, if this was an alternative holding, would be binding in both senses. But if the court merely mentions something in passing as background or as explanation for something that wasn't briefed and wasn't decided as a matter intended to be decided as a legal question, then it's not binding on future panels as per that en banc decision. Getting back to Judge Canby's question, what's important to remember is that when you own a particular copy of a CD, you own not only it's not just a piece of plastic you're talking about. There's a piece of plastic, yes, but there's also the copy that's on the plastic. And this is easier to understand in the concept of books. For example, if you buy a book, nobody's going to tell you that you don't have a right to read it, that the publisher retains ownership of the words in the book. When you buy the copy of a book, you own that copy. That includes the physical thing with the printed words in it.
Well, does the phrase owner of a copy have the same meaning in both the first sale doctrine and the essential step defense?
Yes, and I think both parties in this case agree that the meaning is identical. And that's why there can't be, as you just heard from Autodesk, there can't be a different rule for software than from other kinds of goods. So if this court is going to say that there's a rule for licensing that applies to software, it also has to take into account all the people who are out there who are still reading books and who want to retain ownership of those copies in their possession.
Well, let's say that the publisher decides to take a leaf out of the book of the software manufacturers and starts manufacturing books in shrink wrap and saying, and now we're getting books over our Kindle and whatever else, says, this is for your personal use only. You can't transfer it to someone else. You can't make a copy, and we license you to use it for your personal use only. Why isn't that, why couldn't the book manufacturer do that? It's just a different model of how it's currently done.
Well, that is precisely what the publisher tried to do in Bob's Merrill. They tried to...
Not exactly. I mean, the book was published, it was put out in the market, and then there was the little mark saying, our license is limited to selling for under a dollar, whatever, over a dollar, whatever it was. That's not exactly the same model as what the software companies are doing.
It's very close, though, because that was an inscription inside the book.
Well, but very close... You know, what if that only counts in horseshoes and hand grenades or something?
Right.
So, well, you know, I mean, it is distinguishable. Bob Mills is not exactly the same as what the software people are talking about.
Every case is distinguishable somehow, but the point is that each case had a notice that was included with the copyrighted product that purported to withhold the right to distribute. That's what happened in Bob's Merrill and here. Here is just a notice that's included in the packaging. In Bob's Merrill, it was a notice that was included in the book. And they both used the word license to purport to restrict distribution rights.
Go ahead.
So you're saying if there's the license in this case, there's a contract that's entered into between the manufacturer and the first recipient or the purchaser, and that's not enforceable. It's not really a license. Is that your position?
No, because I think that this may be a case, and there will be many cases where there will be an enforceable contract.
But you're saying this one is not enforceable between Autodesk and, I guess it was CTA, that's not an enforceable contract.
No, we have not made that argument. In this case, there was an agreement that apparently was reached between counsel. There seems to have been arm's length negotiation. It sounds like the kind of contract that would probably be binding. And I'm just saying that when CTA agrees to a contract, then Werner, someone who has nothing to do with that contract and didn't even know about it at the time, is not bound by that agreement. And the important reason...
Well, the question is whether CTA owned it, right? I mean, if CTA went out and stole something and then your client bought it from them, it doesn't matter. It's still stolen merchandise. It can be taken back.
That's absolutely right. So that is ultimately the question. Like I said, if there was an actual lease here, if Autodesk were to give people the software and it was understood that they were leasing it, that you had to pay periodic payments, you had to return it at the end of a lease period, for example, that's an example of an obvious lease.
Well, let me ask you this. If we read the My Systems Corp. versus Peak Computers as holding that software licensees are categorically ineligible for 17 U.S.C., Section 117 protection. Can you still prevail?
Yes, I think so, because MAI, I'm not sure if it's MAI or MAI. I heard you say
I don't know either.
Well, I've been saying MAI, so I'm going to stick with that. But
all right.
MAI was about it's sort of a remnant of the older model of software licensing. This was software that was included on a computer at the time that it was sold. It was manufactured by the computer manufacturer. It was made to run a particular computer. And so the particular copy at issue in that case was the physical computer that was being sold to the company. And that was the particular copy at issue. Now, there were significant restrictions on access to that computer that are different from the restrictions in this case. There was a limited number of people. I think there were three people who were allowed access to the computer at any given time. And so, you know, physically segregating a physical object from the rest of the world could be an indication of lack of ownership. For example, if I gave a rare book that I owned to a library and said, please safeguard this book for me, but don't touch it and don't do anything with it, but you don't say anything about coming back to get it later, that could still be, I think, a reasonable court could conclude that transaction does not transfer ownership based on the particularities of that transaction. But in the run of the cases, the main point, the main factors that are going to strongly indicate that there's a lease rather than a sale are whether the payment is all made at once or whether it's...
Well, what difference does it make if it's not a lease? I guess I'm not understanding that. I mean, it's a different sort of contract. It's a license, not a lease. Are you saying unless it's a lease, it doesn't count? It transfers ownership?
I'm saying that the way that Autodesk uses the word license is synonymous with lease. They're saying that this is a transfer.
But then you're saying it doesn't count as a lease. So I don't understand that argument.
Saying that if it were a lease...
But it's not. It's a license. why does it have to be a lease? I don't understand.
I'm resisting the word. I'm using the word lease to mean the same thing as license because, as I said...
None of the cases talk about leases, so we need to talk about licenses.
That's fine. I'm willing to use that word, but I just wanted to point out that the software companies developed this word for the purpose of circumventing the first sale doctrine. And what they're really saying, what matters to me is what they're really saying a license is, not what they call it. That's what Bob Merrill says, that the label isn't going to control. You have to look at what it really is, and what they're saying it really is something akin to a loan or a lease, where you're transferring a physical object that's saying, I'm not giving it to you, I'm keeping it, but you can hold on to it for a while, either in exchange for money or as a loan, but it still does not belong to you.
And you're saying they can't do it, that's not enforceable. Is that what you're saying?
They could do it, but they didn't do it here.
And what would they have had to do? You're saying unless they asked for periodic payments? And I don't understand why they would have to do that, why that's a necessary attribute.
It's not necessary that they do anything, but you have to look at what they actually did to determine what kind of transaction you're looking at rather than looking at the label of the transaction. So the fact that if they did put, for example, periodic payments on it, that would be an indication that what's really going on here is that there's a lease. Now, they don't have to do that. For example, you could loan something to someone without any periodic payments, but it's still clear you have to give it back at the end of a period. That's not transferring ownership. That's what you'd call a loan. And what matters is what actually is going on in the transaction. It doesn't matter at all whether it's called a license, a lease, a sale, a rental, a gift, whatever. That's just simply a name that is put on the transaction.
So just help me understand, what is it that they should have done if they wanted to make sure that they weren't transferring ownership, that they didn't, that they failed to do, in your view?
They need to construct a transaction in which it's clear that they're engaging in a temporary transfer of possession of property without transferring ownership.
And so the property had to come back to them? Is that, you're saying that's dispositive?
I think that's almost always going to be a dispositive factor. I think that's a very, very, very strong factor. And the reason is because if you own something, you're never going to give it away without any expectation of getting it back. That's just inconsistent with the very idea of ownership.
But the fact that they didn't require return, is that dispositive that it's not a license?
It's
under the present case law.
I think that it's dispositive here, and I think it will, in almost every case, be a dispositive factor. I mean, there's going to be cases, I think, for example, the Augusto case.
So if they had required that it be returned, you would lose. You concede that?
No, because if they require a return...
But you just said 30 seconds ago that would be dispositive.
I said it will usually be dispositive, almost always be dispositive. And if Autodesk does that, not because they have any...
Don't make me cross-examine you here.
If Autodesk does it just for the purpose of creating the appearance that they have an interest in the software when in fact they don't, then what you have is a sham, not a real transfer of possession.
All right. I think we have your argument in mind. Your time has expired. Thank you for your argument.
If Mr. Beck said that the software companies invented the idea of a license to circumvent the first sale doctrine, putting aside inventing, I think that gives us too much credit.
Well, I am concerned, the point that I think that he did raise, I am concerned that I think that, does your position mean that all copyright owners can avoid the first sale doctrine by packaging their products with a restrictive license, a restrictive form licensing agreement? And that being said, why would this not extend the Copyright Act's exclusive distribution right beyond what Congress intended? So that's I'm concerned about what you're asking us to do from that standpoint.
I concede, Judge Callahan, that there has to be substance here. It is, in a sense, the answer to your question is yes, provided that there is substance. I start with the proposition that somebody who owns something can sell it or not sell it as it chooses in this country. And the software companies who created the software, got the copyright, and manufactured the disk can sell it or they cannot sell it. They could lend it for a week. They could do a lot of things. They choose the terms on which they will transfer it to someone. And in this case, they choose to transfer it subject to substantial restrictions on use and transfer and say, these are the sticks in effect, these are the sticks you're getting and these are the sticks we're keeping. And the law then determines the consequences of that transaction. And Congress has made the judgment that if they sell it, that is if they transfer enough of the sticks to constitute ownership, the first sale doctrine applies. And yes, I concede that this could be done with other with books or recordings. If the market would sustain it, it would have an effect, I suppose, on price. People now resell their CDs and books. If they couldn't do it anymore, they might be willing to pay less. They might only be willing to pay less. The market takes these things into account. But Congress hasn't stepped into this breach to say these things can or cannot be done. And which leads me to what I think is the sort of most important point about this case.
All right, going into overtime, so wrap it up.
I think I have 30 seconds.
No, you're going, watch, it's counting up.
Oh, it's counting up. Okay. All right, I'll be really quick. I appreciate the indulgence. This is a question of statutory interpretation. There isn't a bit of indication in the legislation itself or the legislative history, if one looks at it, that Congress has ever intended to impose, in effect, a prohibition on the licensing model. And there are clearly winners and losers from such a rule as Verner advocates. And when you have such a complex market and an industry structure, and a rule is proposed that would have enormous consequences, adverse to the industry, adverse to some consumers, perhaps benefiting others, that's a task that Congress has to weigh. Verner is inviting the court to decide who the winners and losers should be without a shred of legislative authorization. Thank you.
Thank you. This matter will stand submitted. Thank you again, both parties, for your helpful argument in this matter.